Shrink Wrap Radio number 578, Mintelligence, A New Psychology of Thinking, with Dr. Kristen Lee.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my return guest is Dr. Kristen Lee, who I interviewed back on episode number 457, A Proactive Approach to Stress. Today, we'll be speaking about her new book, Mintelligence, A New Psychology of Thinking. For more information about Kristen Lee, EDD, and MSW, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Kristen Lee, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm so happy to have you back on the show. Last time we spoke about your book, Reset, which was all about dealing with stress and burnout. And this time we're going to focus on your new book, which I think is about to come out, right?
That's right. It's available pre-order now, but it will release in February.
Wonderful. How exciting. And the title of this one is Mintelligence, A New Psychology of Thinking. And it goes on to say, learn what it takes to be more agile, mindful, and connected in today's world. That sounds like a big order, but also very exciting. So before we get into the new book, I want to say congratulations on your TEDx presentation in, I guess it was in Ocala, Florida. And yeah. That's a big deal.
Thank you. It was a wonderful opportunity to share my work and to be surrounded by amazing people with incredible stories. And, you know, as we get into the discussion today around Mintelligence, the TED Talk really gave me a platform and an opportunity to share some of the key highlights out of research and teaching that I've been doing for years at the university.
Yeah. And have you had theater training?
No, I haven't. No.
Well, you were so dramatic in your presentation. Got a lot of body language in there and so on. So it made me think, oh, well, she's had some kind of training for this.
That might be learned behavior. I'm the youngest in my family, so I probably had to do a lot to get noticed in the family.
Maybe that's it. Yeah, that would make sense.
But I've also had the privilege of, you know, traveling around the world to share my message. And so I think just in speaking with so many folks, you learn to develop deep insight and perspective as a result. But then also, I think we also need a sense of humor. Yeah. It's such an important part of resilience and communicating, because so much of what we're dealing with is so heavy. And so I made an effort to really use a lot of humor, especially self-depreciating humor.
Sure.
That I think helps people connect, knowing that, you know, none of us have it all together every minute of the day.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I like about both your presentation and your book, is that you kind of acknowledge that quite a bit.
Which
certainly makes me feel more comfortable. No, I don't have it together all the time. Mm-hmm. Your TEDx presentation was seemed to be about encouraging people to have the courage to be authentic, to be real, to not worry so much about their self-image, and to move away from preoccupation with self to more of an us orientation. Does that pretty much capture it?
That's exactly right. You know, we're inundated with messages that we have to hyper-perform or be airbrushed everywhere we go. And, you know, authentic is like a lot of buzzwords that come up that kind of become trite and overused. And, you know, everyone's trying to grasp that how we can show up as our real self. But often that gets sabotaged in light of social media, you know, just everything that's propagated within the news. And, you know, just these notions that we have to start a nonprofit by the time we're 12 or look like the Kardashians. You know, there's all these ideas that are swirling all the time that get into our consciousness and erode our sense of self, our identities, and our well-being.
Yeah. And I think your book goes into those areas. It really fits very well from the the TEDx presentation that you did. I kind of realized after some reflection. I'm wondering, was there anything going on in your life to trigger this book?
Absolutely. So one of the ways I describe it is that I underwent what I call a soul excavation. And what I mean by that is, you know, everybody has a developmental path with lots of things happening. And at the time that I was writing and conducting the research that the book is based on, I was going through a lot of life changes, a lot of transitions, starting with an empty nest of my children who are raised now, my mom being sick, and just a lot of personal variables that were becoming very challenging. And also, I think for many of us, I think many people can identify with sort of these generational tides in our lives, the ways we're acculturated, the ways we're indoctrinated into certain systems of belief. And, you know, Dave, as we think about indoctrination, a lot of times that automatically comes up in terms of religion. And I kind of got into higher ed 8 years ago after working as a clinician for the past 22 years. And at first I thought, you know, science was going to solve everything for me. Like, this was it. This is my ticket. Because I had been brought up in a very restrictive religious tradition where there's a lot of good things, a lot of great values, but there were holes. And so for me, you know, I started to get really involved with my students, trying to look at these notions of identity and of resilience and what was contributing to us flourishing in life and what was getting in the way. And I was recognizing that indoctrination really goes across society. You know, all of our social structures and institutions, you know, we're told we have to look a certain way, we have to behave according to gender expectations. And there's just so much that we're being sold about who we're supposed to be. And I was seeing so much evidence in my students, the patients that I was serving, and then in my own life that I realized, you know, we need to look at things a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. So one of the ways I talk about my work is that we can rethink our way to the good life. And, you know, as you know, positive psychologists talk a lot about human flourishing and this notion of the good life. But again, in our world, we're often taught it's a goods life, it's consumerism, it's the stuff we have, or it's the letters after our name, or it's status. And what we know from a scientific perspective is those are not the things that actually bring on human happiness at all. And in fact, they're the things that often get in the way and disrupt it.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned your students, and you refer to it as your research. And in fact, I guess this book partly arises out of, it became a research project springing from a class that you were teaching, a graduate course, I gather.
That's right.
To MBA types, was that the course?
So they were across various graduate programs where I was teaching, but most of them in organizational communication studies. Mm-hmm. And what happened was my boss approached me and he asked me if I'd be willing to teach a personal branding class. And I almost hung up on him when he asked me this. I thought, oh, you know, is it going to be like this creepy sales pitch and that they have to start their own nonprofit by the time they're 12 and, you know, just all this hyper-performance stuff. And I didn't want anything to do with it, but I agreed. And as we got into it, I saw students doing exactly some of the things that concerned me, you know, kind of holding up their will work for A signs, right? Like, I'll do anything to get that A. And, you know, just ideas around what it means to be worthy in today's market. But then as I started to read my students' papers and start to really look at how they were defining authentic, I realized that many of them had overcome, you know, the bait that society was trying to hook them in with. And they had started to recognize that in order for them to really flourish, in order for them to really feel a strong sense of purpose and impact, they had to move away from the me stuff and move to more of a we mindset. And so, what happened, you know, when I started to see all this come through, I immediately filed an IRB and then started, which is a little bit, I think, in hindsight.
A lot of people won't know what an IRB is.
Yeah. So an IRB is the application that you need to conduct human research.
Right.
So the students, their stories were so powerful and so poignant. And I wanted to capture what they were telling me. So it ended up launching me into this grounded theory research study, which basically helps you go on this excavation, an expedition, if you will, in order to form a new theory. And the theory really, again, just in layman's terms, is moving from I to we. It's collective efficacy rather than sometimes the way we've thought about it. Like Albert Bandura, for example, great social psychologist, talks about self-efficacy. You know, the idea that if we think we can reach a goal, we're more likely to set it and then go on to reach it. But with collective efficacy, there was much more of a concern for human regard, for human well-being, recognizing our systemic issues, recognizing how polarization, how disparities, how isms affect us, and wanting to actually get in there and make a difference. You know, that we're not just so me, myself, and I oriented, but we actually care about the collective good.
Yeah, and isn't a big part of our collective, our culture, you know, has a whole lot of staked out around individuality.
We are individualistic. We are bootstrappers all the way.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're really, you know, reared to be very competitive. And I think, you know, a lot of it does go into the science of, you know, primitive instincts, right? And our tendency to want to stay safe with our in-groups, you know, to stay in protected territory. Mm-hmm. And I think
and there are a lot of ways that's not working for us today, right?
That's right, especially when we have unprecedented opportunities to connect worldwide. You know, we have a global world, yeah, and we have amazing opportunities to really be a large community, yeah, rather than kind of being in our own corners, you know, staking out our ground, fighting, saying it's our way or you know, the highway.
Yeah. Yeah,
that kind of thing, I think, you know, especially in authoritarian models of government, ways of being, that whole idea that, you know, we're right and you're wrong and othering people, that hasn't really had the best track record.
Right. And unfortunately, right now in the political situation, mm-hmm, it seems like we're leading with that, which is
that's
too
right.
bad. Yeah.
And sometimes people are tricked by that. Like they think that that's alleged strength, you know, they think right. that that's power, but we know that those power over dynamics and the polarization and the lack of a search for common ground, those are the things that erode the fabric of individuals, families, communities, societies all across the world.
Yeah. Well, in your class, initially, these students were presenting to you their best face and their very upwardly mobile selves.
Yeah.
And, somehow you needed to kind of wake them up and crack through that. How did you manage to do that, to connect with them in a more real way?
It took a little time. At first, I felt a little bit impatient, but I think there was also behind that impatience my own experience as what I would call a straddler. So for myself, as a first-generation college student, someone who grew up in a blue-collar, middle-class background, worked four jobs in my undergrad years, finally over the years made my way to academia, I was experiencing what I think they were experiencing, which is known as imposter syndrome. And so it's that feeling like, you know, you don't fit in, someone's going to find you out, you don't really deserve the spot. So I think that it was starting to kind of, you know, put the mirror back on myself and make me really rethink it. And I think, again, just looking at my own personal lived experience in those ways, looking at the way the students were overcoming some of those ideas that they had of themselves, those faulty ideas. And then also looking across our systems that just have these ridiculous expectations, you know, that none of us, you know, and think about robotics and just, you know, like the way the world is moving, it never feels like enough. Like we can never outperform our, you know, there's always something more we can be doing.
Yeah.
And I remember one day in class, one of my students said, "Dr. Chris, I'm so sick of having to jump through all these hoops." You know, so we started to talk about the hoops, you know, the athletic, the scholastic, you know, the just all the things that we think we have to joke like Amy Schumer. You know, you have to have everything in life to be considered worthy. And I think, you know, that work, it was a reciprocal process of growth to really see, you know, those exchanges with the students that really started to change me and make me realize that, you know, I had changing to do in order to help hopefully dismantle some of this together.
And in fact, you actually share some of your own work right up front in the book. In the introduction, you start off talking about going into therapy to
yeah.
deal with your own perfectionism, a history of trying to be very acceptable.
Yes.
At the least, right?
Yeah. I think so many of us are trained to hustle for acceptance right from day one. Uh-huh. And that takes a lot of unlearning. It takes a lot of unlearning about behavior. And I think especially for those of us in behavioral sciences and the work that we do, you know, and generationally, we're trained to have, you know, be very contained in our boundaries. And there's good reason for that. And we're trained to, you know, sort of like we're the expert and we're the ones that hold the knowledge. And certainly for me, as both a clinician and an academic, I think that pressure, again, to perform in those ways, to meet those expectations, that was very present in my mind's eye. And through all this work, I realized, you know, I needed to get some therapy and deal with the perfectionism, to deal with, you know, those dark emotions that I feel. And then it helped me to actually go public and take it a step further and talk about my lived experience with anxiety and depression as a person who deals with that on a clinical level, who deals with very dark emotions, who deals with mood dysregulation. And I have to work very hard to kind of keep myself calibrated. I have to engage in a lot of activities like lifestyle medicine. So watching my sleep, my nutrition, how I take care of myself, and then who I surround myself with. And again, just not working the 80 hours a week. It's very easy for me to relapse all the time.
Yeah,
and to default into those performing modes. And especially, you know, as a mother, as a professional, as a daughter, you know, there's lots of layers and there's lots of...
Sure. Was it a struggle for you to decide to lead, to open the book with, I have to go to therapy to deal with this and here's what my issues are?
Any sense of ego or trepidation, I think that had been worn down through the years, and especially over the past few years, because I've traveled with so many amazing souls out there. You know, I've been going internationally and domestically, and just what happened is when I went to therapy, I then decided I needed to come out and talk about this more publicly and more specifically and not be vague about it. So I did that at work in front of all my colleagues. And that was really scary to do that. And when I did it, I almost, you know, didn't go back to the office after. I was pretty feeling, ashamed of myself. I felt, and then I'm thinking, you know, so much of my work as an activist and as a mental health clinician has been about eradicating stigma and also discrimination about anyone who has a lived experience with any kind of mental health issue. And I think there's just so much, you know, so many misconceptions. And now we have all this brain science that just shows how prone we are to dysregulation, how these are brain-based illnesses and differences and dysregulations. Mm-hmm. And so for me, like, to know all this from a science perspective and an academic perspective, to do this professionally, to encourage people to get therapy, and then to not be able to admit myself that I need therapy, I think it's pretty hypocritical. So I think by the time I got to the writing, I decided that should be the lead. And sometimes I still feel very vulnerable. This TED Talk just came out. I didn't even leave the house the day it came out because I talk about my lived experience with anxiety there. And I was like, oh, people are going to see this. And, you know, that whole thing, you start to go into that.
Sure.
But then I realized it's not about me. It's about, you know, the fact that I have this privilege of having education and these roles and this expertise, these letters after my name. And I need to use those in a way that helps people rethink their labels, that helps them rethink these archaic, antiquated ideas about mental health. And it's almost like the Hans Christian Andersen, the naked guy in the room, right? Everybody has some kind of mental health issue. This is my posit. You know, everybody has touch with it in their family. You know, one of my classes, we were talking about the opioid crisis, for example, and every one of my students was personally affected on some level. So I feel my job is to be an intelligent voice for change in these opportunities that I have to share.
Yeah.
And I think that's the best way to do it, to just break the ice.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there'll be people who will be critical, but that's not important to me. What's important is that we can see each other eye to eye in our shared humanity and all of our strengths and wonder, and all of our brokenness and flaws as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, good for you. And, you know, I'm struck with the fact that this is, in some ways, an unending task, because I'm sort of a product of the 60s when I was in graduate school, and I was drawn to humanistic psychology for that very... It was putting out a very similar kind of message, calling for authenticity, calling for self-exploration and being open with people, etc. Now that sort of morphed into positive psychology in an interesting way, because the movement doesn't give any credit to humanistic psychology. But, so I guess these ideas need to be continually reborn and reaffirmed, because there, as you say, there's a lot of external programming, much of which is, it's just, we're like the fish in water, you know, and not aware of it. It's just, it's part of our given to be competitive, to have all of this drive, to feel like we have to mask our vulnerabilities, et cetera, all of those things that you're challenging here. And, you know, it was wonderful that you had the courage to come out with your colleagues. That could have gone very badly or not. Often when we engage in self-disclosure and admit some of our vulnerabilities and weaknesses and self-judgments and so on, if we engage in appropriate self-disclosure, that can encourage other people to let down their guard. And a kind of bonding can happen around that. That's always been the basis of my whole trip, if you will. But absolutely. I found, I always emphasize to my students that there's a difference between appropriate self-disclosure and inappropriate self-disclosure. So you have to use your brain and your inner wisdom, you know, like, I want to expose myself, but I don't want to go so far that I won't be able to come back to the to the next faculty meeting because I was too naked.
Well said. And I think especially in light of social media and how everybody seems to put everything out there, you know, and I think to the credit of the millennials, they're really very bold in terms of disclosure and, you know, the lexicon we have now, the ways people can describe their lived experiences has shifted so much from generation to generation, which I think in many ways is a great triumph. But I think it's also very important to your point around safe disclosure and sort of, you know, it's classic. It feels like everybody's just wearing everything on their sleeves. They're putting everything out there. I think we need to, you know, again, keep working to reframe the conversation as thoughtful as we can, you know, to understand, you know, brain science, to understand how our amygdalas work under pressure, to understand primitive instincts, and just all of the things that influence the ways in which we think, the ways in which we engage with one another. And I think, you know, again, I think we're going to continue to see monumental shifts in the way this conversation unfolds and transpires.
Yeah.
But,
One of the things that intrigues me is that, you know, as you're referring to how the brain works and so on, and this is something I've been struck by in a number of conversations that I've had recently with people who are in the what might be called neuropsychotherapy camp, is that they all lean a lot on education and on educating their clients and saying, hey, this is your brain, and here's how it works. And there's a way in which that lifts a lot of the stigma. And that's what I'm hearing you saying as well.
That
it's not a moral failing. It's got something to do with how we're wired and how our brains work, and that there are vulnerabilities as well as strengths in all of that.
That's right. And so it's this whole movement around meta-awareness, metacognition. And metacognition, as you know, simply means thinking about thinking. And that's an amazing gift we have as human beings, that we have the capacity to evaluate our thinking and make needed modifications. So that's really at the heart of my work and my efforts that I use, not only in my own life for my own variables, but with my students, with those I serve, in many, many ways, you know, how we can look at the refinements that we need in order to make better decisions in order to have a better, you know, new lenses in which we can see ourselves and to see the world.
So the title of your book is Mintelligence, kind of a coined word, I gather.
Yeah.
So what is Mintelligence? And, you know, why did you choose that word?
So it's a fusion of the
words. Why did you create that word, I should say?
It's a fusion. It's a fusion of the words mental and intelligence. And as you know, there's many frameworks of emotional intelligence, multiple intelligences. Mintelligence, you know, allows us to wield new lenses. It's a new psychology of thinking. So again, it's based on all of this research and teaching work that I've been doing at the university. And so oftentimes, as you know, when you think about human behavior and human functioning, the classic default is to talk about when things aren't going well, we automatically think of a downward spiral, right? Oh, something's gone wrong. It's a downward spiral. So the way that I structure Mintelligence is to harness what positive psychologists talk about, is that we can actually have upward spirals. So in each chapter, which I call sessions, there's an opportunity to unlearn a certain kind of indoctrination and pivot towards a new way of thinking. So that's the essence of Mintelligence. And it's funny because that word was born when I was talking to my agent. We were getting ready to contract with my publisher. And you know how book titles can be, you know, just coming up with titles and how do you engage with people. And I remember saying, I don't want to lose my intelligence in this. I never want to sort of have this like glammy kind of title or something that's not going to be substantive. So I kept thinking a lot about the words mental and mental health. And, you know, again, that's all my life's work and how there's so much connotation around that word, both words, mental and intelligence. So I really wanted to create that fusion and help people rethink those terms. And again, even I know that you live and breathe and eat psychology, right? And if we look at many of the foundations of psychology, they've been overturned by new science and new evidence-based ways of thinking. So even in the book, I talk about things like the Rorschach inkblot test, you know, how that was created and how there's even practitioners to this day that still use that as an allegedly valid way of measuring someone's perceptions. And what I try to point out throughout is these ideas that a lot of these things we make judgments on that we believe are the basis for evaluation are subjective. They don't really tell the whole picture of human essence, of human capabilities, of human multidimensionality. And so we really need, again, to be able to rethink things in order to do that spiraling up, in order to be able to unlearn old behavior, unlearn old paradigms, and think about how they persist in therapy rooms, classrooms, boardrooms, living rooms, like all across the board. A lot of times we're basing our knowledge on stuff that has already been proven inaccurate and subjective. And that's actually not just like an interesting or clever fact. That's actually dangerous. And the other thing that I write about and I'm very concerned with is if you look across even academic literature that's peer-reviewed, that's solid, that's substantive, even that is being called weird. So weird is an acronym that stands for Western, Educated, Industrialized, Rich, and Democratic Nation. So a lot of the research we're even basing, like our assessment of the human condition and whatnot.
So you're saying there's an unconscious bias there? Is that what you're saying?
That's right. That's right. We're not really getting like the full slice of human experience and of human spectrum.
Amen.
And then picture them the news, like then the news is basing it all, just everything. I call it the fluff. So I'm from Boston, as you know, and the state sandwich here is a fluffernutter. Have you ever seen this at all?
No, I've been in Boston, but a fluffernutter?
Oh, it's terrible. It's peanut butter on white bread with this stuff called fluff. So it's this white, gooey, sugary, like it's all sugar. A lot of times, even in psychological realms, there's that pop psychology, there's that fluff. And we're not getting the protein and the substance of empirical, evidence-based studies. And then, you know, you translate that. You can talk about that within the ivory tower, right? But then if you take that onto the road and you think about the news and people's agendas and the ways that they're reporting alleged truth, we're really not doing the thinking we need and getting the information we need to live good lives, to live lives that are characterized by connection and presence with each other and creativity. Instead, we're often just being dragged around, you know, I call it being chicken littled, you know, so that old parable of the chicken little, the sky is falling.
Right.
And we live in these fear-based modes instead of in well-grounded ways where we can actually make deliberate decisions and actually assess what's going on and then be able to be thoughtful, global, conscious citizens.
Yeah. Boy, if we're directed at all by the news, that's going to get you in chicken little mode right fast.
For sure.
One of the things that I loved is when you write, we should be skeptical of any advice that makes big promises or overemphasizes life's complexity to a simple 1-2-3 solution. There's no quick X one-size-fits-all formula to crack life's code. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a great statement in a self-help book. Mm-hmm. It sort of tempers it. It's okay. Saying, you know, because your book in some ways is a Jeremiad. It's like you're on a campaign, you know, to wake people up and to have them shed the scales from their eyes and look reality head on and be brave to in terms of self-disclosure and so on. But at the same time, you're saying. This isn't necessarily the end-all, be-all. As a matter of fact, at the end of your book, you've got a disclaimer that kind of says, hey, you don't have to agree with everything I've said. And if you disagree, that's great. And mm-hmm. stand up for that, you know, and learn more about that. And what's the substance behind that? So I like both your passion that comes through, but also your humility and attempt to find that place of balance. which I think really, really happens in your book. Getting into your book a bit more, you've divided it into four sections. Mm-hmm. And each section, I was going to ask you sessions, but the sessions are really like little homework kind of thing or exercises for people to kind of write and think about, do some self-reflection. And so if I can step you through the parts of the book and ask you some questions about them, the four sections are, the first section is called the waking up sessions. Mm-hmm. The second section is the tuning in sessions, and the third is the breaking out sessions, and the fourth is the going beyond mm-hmm. sessions. So let's start with part one, the waking up sessions, which you've subtitled Find Your Reflective Lens. Mm-hmm. Waking up from what?
Waking up from unconsciousness. And again, this really ties back to the meta-awareness. Is again, they say that we're taking in the equivalent of 174 newspapers every day. Many people that I know say they're doing the equivalent of two or three people's jobs. So the pace, the sheer pace of our lives, and again, all the things we put on our checklist or we think we have to do, it causes us to perhaps miss the chance to be reflective, to recognize, again, you know, what's happening around us, what's being sold to us, to recognize even our behaviors, our lack of thinking, maybe our abuse of our bodies or just, you know, that constant breakneck speed. We might be missing, we might be asleep and not aware of the ways that we can actually unlearn, you know, performance-based indoctrination or me, myself, and I indoctrination and become more agile, become more aware of, you know, again, what my research overwhelmingly revealed and so much of the literature affirms is that when we move from performance to impact, that's when we get to the good life. So just waking up from, again, all the noise. I think a lot of times we just mm-hmm. shut down or we think it's just going to be too hard to accomplish any kind of positive behavioral change. So waking up is learning to be more meta-aware, more reflective, you know, more able to pivot away from the things that just cause us to not be effective as human beings.
Yeah, you use the metaphor of that we're sleepwalkers.
Yeah.
That we're kind of, I guess we're going where our culture, our family has kind of pointed us, and sometimes with a kind of automaticity, I think that's a word.
Yeah.
And so you're called, when you talk about the reflective lens, you're talking about kind of shifting to, as you say, a meta perspective, looking at our lives, trying to wake up from the parts of us that are just kind of automatic and, okay, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? And why am I doing it this way? Why am I so driven? And I'm thinking about this as I'm asking some of these questions. I mean, here I am with over 700 interviews when I was supposedly retired, you know, and I'm still doing market research too. Mea culpa. As I'm going through this book, I'm realizing, okay, I got a lot of these issues myself were all, in some ways, were sort of on the wheel, on the in the hamster cage, the hamster wheel, right?
Absolutely.
Going and
going,
you know,
just going back to the point about the fluff, and just again, like trying to consider what's being sold towards us, you know, to us, and saying, wait, this isn't actually working for me, or this actually isn't true, or this isn't okay. So, you know, this whole section really gives you chances to think about values. I think that's been, for me, a very pivotal aspect of growth and development. And I require my students to, there's actually a wonderful inventory called the Values in Action Inventory. And it's by Martin Seligman, the father of positive psychology.
Yeah.
It's a really great exercise to go through and look at your values and say, do my behaviors line up with my values? And if you do that exercise, you know, it can be simple. You don't have to take that inventory. I love inventories. And by the way, I have an intelligence quiz on my website that helps do some of this meta work here, you know. But if we think about our values and to what extent we're living them out, that's going to be a great, kind of what we used to say when we were kids, the 10-finger boost when someone helps you climb the tree. It gives you that huge boost you need to get to that next level of consciousness and awareness that's needed given the complexity of our world.
That probably relates to the part two of your book, which is tuning in and finding your mindful lens. And so what are we tuning into is the obvious follow-on question.
I love seeing the traction that mindfulness is getting. And you've heard me say that mindfulness has kind of become like the new kale. It seems to become.
I thought that was a great phrase because because I've said maybe we're in a mindfulness bubble.
Yeah. It just seems like it's just the
it's
surge
everywhere.
Has been amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think, again, it's a rebuttal to these conditions of, you know, people thinking, again, they have to be perfect, or that somehow we can kind of fill the void in our life with stuff or with busyness or with accomplishments or so-called success. And we're just in this frenetic way of operating, you know, as I say, like human doings, not beings. And we know all of the research and the history of mindfulness really shows us something that I think is disruptive. Honestly, it's not, again, this isn't like the fun part of the book, but this notion of impermanence. And I think generationally, I think just in general, it's hard to get our minds around impermanence, the idea that nothing stays the same, that change is the only constant, that loss and grief are constant aspects of life. One of my favorite authors, Glennon Doyle, she calls life brutiful, you know, being both brutal and beautiful. And, you know, just the fact of aging, you know, we're all aging. You know, life is just full of these transitions that are really hard to bear. And mindfulness allows us that non-judgmental awareness, you know, so we're awake already, but we're tuned in to the beauty and the horror of life, like the sheer devastation of all the losses that we contend with. But also that gives us the freedom to be really present in the moment. And I love the word relish, but to relish and to savor the good moments, the connections we have, the beauty around us in nature and in one another, right? Just in our shared humanity. But to also recognize that nothing stays the same. And that work of being present and mindful is something that I think will really help us dismantle some of the frenetic energy, the perfectionism, the fears. You know, I think it's a freeing thing to actually acknowledge, like the poem that says, "Nothing gold can stay." That's actually a favorite poem of my son, who's 18. And we talk a lot about this thing of impermanence. And he's a pretty wise guy. You know, he's 18. And we like to have these kinds of conversations around life and meaning and, you know, just how we can really savor the positive moments, but also learn to tolerate the distress of life.
That's great that you can have those kinds of conversations with your son.
I feel so fortunate. He's definitely a philosopher in the making. Uh-huh. he's one of the people that the book is dedicated to because, you know, I always say about my students that they're just as much my teachers as I am theirs. And I very much feel that way about both my son and my daughter. You know, having the privilege of being a parent, it's a wild ride. You know, it's not a linear process.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you're triggering for me a memory. I was looking back over some of the correspondence or something around our earlier interview. Yeah. And I saw a message from you, an email or something, wishing me, I think I shared with you something that was going on with one of my sons who was facing a profound medical crisis. Mm-hmm. And, so I just want to catch, I found your response so supportive and caring and felt a real connection as a result of that, continue to feel that connection. And I just want to update you without going into the whole story here that that's been a 180-degree miracle of terrific. Just his life is just, he's thriving now, having wonderful. Come through this terrible medical crisis and psychological and spiritual crisis to just a place where he's really thriving. So,
amazing. I'm so glad to hear.
That's part of the story of change is that it can go from good to bad, but it can also go from bad to good.
That's right. I think it's a really helpful thing for everyone to think about as they share this conversation with us, right?
Yeah.
Because sometimes we feel so stuck and so much despair, but we are wired to heal and shift happens. So I'm really glad to hear that. That's terrific.
Yeah. Shift happens. That's a good. we know shit happens, but we don't often hear that shift happens. I'm not sure I've heard that before. That's great. That's great. Well, moving on to part three, which is called the Breaking Out Sessions, and Find Your Global Lens. Mm-hmm. So breaking out of what?
Breaking out of insularity, which is just a fancy way of saying our in-groups, the places where we are, you know, kind of like our own territory, our own people that look like us, that think like us, that, you know, hold the same kinds of beliefs. And you know, for me, working at Northeastern in Boston, we have 11,000 international students. So through the time I've been in academia, especially, I've had this privilege of working with students from across the world. And what I've, and again, as part of this research project and writing endeavor, but just all these observations have shown me that we're really indoctrinated with a very precise belief system in our families of origin. So it's culture, it's religion, it's family norms, generational norms, all these expectations. And that gives us a sense of identity, right? A sense of self, a sense of community, a place of belonging. But those of us who venture off and we go across the world or outside of our group, sometimes that can become both elevating and unsettling. And so what I mean by that is we can feel this kind of epic tension between who what our families think we're supposed to be, or our social group, or the groups we identify with, and, you know, what they want. And then with this new growth, if you see yourself as a global citizen, you tend to be perpetually curious. You love novelty and variety. You love diversity. You love to venture off beyond the bounds. You love to challenge convention. And so breaking out is about getting off those islands that we're born into. And there's so many binaries. There's so many, like, you know, ways we're categorized, whether it's the gender binary or, again, just a religious affiliation, cultural affiliations. And there's certain behaviors that are expected out of us that don't necessarily.
When you say binary, that's kind of like either or attitudes.
Yes. That's right. Like, you're either in this category or the other. So with gender, for example, you have a girl that she's going to wear pink, and then she's expected to do, you know, act certain ways. And then think of all the labels we assign according to gender, you know, don't be a crybaby to boys, or don't be so bossy to girls. So those are examples. But being a global thinker isn't just about geographic boundaries. It's that, but it's also just being much more universal and broad in the way that we embrace and know and appreciate human spectrum, so that we see outside of, again, like our insular groups that maybe just keep us thinking it's us versus them or they're the other. It allows us to seek common ground and to see across humanity that we have a lot more in common than what we realize, and that diversity and difference can be appreciated. I think that's, again, one of my biggest pet peeves is the word tolerance. We got to teach tolerance, right? To me, tolerance is like, yeah, I'll tolerate mushy cereal or a long line at the store. But why do we have to tolerate people? You know, to me, if you really appreciate human spectrum and you open your mind up and you have interactions with a lot of people who are different than yourself, that gives you the best gift you could ever have.
Yeah, you know, this, what you're saying sheds light on the subtitle of the book, which at first seemed a little bit overreaching, The New Psychology of Thinking. But what you're really calling for is that we think differently, that we think more broadly, more widely, with fewer filters and so on. Yeah, so it's really a call. And you talk about the need to purge the Kool-Aid and to get unthrust. And I guess what you're talking about there are all those things that we kind of take for granted, that we've sort of been programmed to as part of our sleepwalk.
Do
I have that right?
You have it right on. Well said.
Okay. And to kind of wrap things up, the fourth part of the book is called The Going Beyond Sessions, Your Imagineering Lens. Yeah. Well, tell us about that. How do we go beyond? And
so this is
this
about
Imagineering Lens?
Yeah. So another word fusion. You can tell I love to play with words, but it's this idea of fusing a new code together and reimagining and engineering a life that works for you. Again, think about just all the choices we have in life, the ways in which we can communicate, move, travel, what we can study, who we can love. There's endless choices. And what's interesting, if you look at research, sometimes too much choice almost seems to overwhelm us and kind of lead us back to that sleepwalking stage. So Imagineering is, again, once you've been able to, and not that this is a linear process, but when you break away and you unlearn that indoctrination and you pivot towards new ways, you then are able to say, I understand, I'm more reflective, I understand myself, what causes me to thrive. I know what the good life means for me. I know it's not going to be the things that are being sold. And instead, I'm going to put together a life that's characterized by my value system, by the things that I know are going to not only bring out the best in myself, but in those that I also have the chance to influence and to help. And so Imagineering is, you know, just being really creative and giving yourself permission to live a life that's worth living. And as I say in my TED Talk, you know, what's the point of living a fake life or a life that's dictated by everybody else's needs and interests or what we think we're supposed to be? It's BS. You know, it's kind of foolish to fall into it. But it's very easy as human beings because we want the comfort of validation, of acceptance, of people pleasing. But at the end of the day, it's our life to live. And again, the key thing is moving beyond the I to the we, you know, and to live a life that allows you. And one of the chapters in this part of the book talks all about work. You know, how many people get burnt out at work and fall into, I got to work 80 hours a week. And this hyper performance that ends up being very damaging. And, you know, I talk about rethinking the way we do things in education, in our work environments, in our families, and you know, really being more creative and imaginative and what's going to work for us and mm-hmm. what's going to bring out the best in human potential. We have so much good to harness, and we have so much, you know, new science and new ways of being able to leverage human, you know, the human condition. And instead, you know, what gets the airtime? It's the negative stuff. It's the polarization. It's all of that. And I think if we can like set that aside, we're going to be able to really, you know, create a life that works well, not only for ourselves, but for everybody.
So it sounds like despite all the negative stuff that's in the news and that's going on in the world, that you are fairly optimistic, that mm-hmm. and that your optimism is kind of in the potential that each person has to kind of wake up and to be more present to themselves and to one another.
I call it skeptimistic. So again, this is a blending of, here I go again.
Yeah.
But it's the skepticism and the optimism. And if we look at the truth, we're in the most prosperous time in human history. You know, we have really made significant strides and improvement in terms of human well-being, you know, many, many outcomes from a global level. However, they say by 2030 that lifestyle sickness is going to trump communicable disease. So we used to worry we're going to catch stuff. Now we're worried about life, you know, stress and anxiety and trying to cope with everything that's at hand. And then, of course, you know, we've got war, we've got all this strife. So I never want to oversimplify or minimize the current conditions, because we have to stay woke to what's happening. And I don't ever want to oversimplify that. Mm-hmm. But however, we are wired for connection, for healing, for resilience. And again, what my research had led me to realize, it's when we fuse our perspectives together, when we find common ground, when we have human solidarity, when we work for pluralism, again, which is just a fancy way of saying, look, we have all of us living together. Let's find a way like to have it be more peaceful. Let's learn from each other. You know, one of my favorite sayings is that everything is learning, and learning is everything. And I think that's one thing. I've had a lot of good mentors in my life who've modeled and embodied that, is that we don't know everything. We're never going to arrive at all the answers. Life is never going to be perfect, but we can always do better. And like you were saying at the top of the hour, just the whole thing around education that helps promote the meta-awareness, but also giving all of us chances to practice these skills, these mindsets, these behaviors that help us to be agile, that help us to be mindful and to be global thinkers, not just kind of, you know, hiding out in the basement of life, afraid to interact or afraid to change. I mean, I think most of us are kind of change adverse, right? Change is kind of hard to swallow and digest. But at the end of the day, if we can be a little more nimble and a little bit more reflective, I think we're going to make progress. And I have a lot of hope. You know, the millennials are kind of like the punching bag of the generation. Everyone says, you know, they're not just lactose intolerant, they're life intolerant, they can't, you know, they're bubble wrap, they can't handle things. But what I see, you know, in this generation are change agents. I see more acceptance and love for everybody across all spectrums. I see more willingness to be courageous and stand up and tell the truth. And so I am very, very hopeful. But I think, again, I say that with a measure of caution, because there's an awful lot going on and there's a lot of noise coming at us. And if we're not awake and we're not thinking, it's going to hurt us. It's going to continue to hurt us.
Yeah. I love your idea, your word of the skeptimist.
Yeah.
There's such a tightrope that we need to walk, that we're called to walk, you know, between skepticism and optimism. And as an interviewer, as a curator of psychology and ideas for my audience, I'm always sort of in that place of being both skeptical but wanting to be optimistic, having my credulity stretched on the one hand, wanting to stay balanced on the other. Mm-hmm. So, and I guess there is no solution to that other than to just be as mindful as one can be.
Mm-hmm.
and as explicit about that and the as you that early sort of quote. So there's no easy answer, so there's no easy formula, mm-hmm. and we're all kind of one foot in front of the other, doing our best to move ahead. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I love the acknowledgement section at the end of your book. You know, often, like many of us, I think, skip to the end of the book often to see, well, what's there, you know? Yeah. And you have this long acknowledgements, list of acknowledgements, where you're thanking people for all sorts of things. And I found it compelling to read. I don't know any of the people that you're thanking, but what comes through is your generosity of spirit and your vivaciousness and energy in that section right there is just a beautiful thing to see and to read.
Thank you. I feel very, very grateful to be in community with so many great thinkers and just so many people in my life that have taught me so much and helped me unlearn some of my own stuff and move forward in a better way. Uh-huh. And I think especially, my students, my children, and then also, this is like a unique thing that I'd never done before, but I was really acknowledging my relatives who passed away and a friend of mine who passed away. And this is sort of the fusion part for me, because again, at the beginning of my journey, I'm so in my head and so intellectually driven, but I felt like this was also very much a spiritually integrated endeavor. And I felt that those people in my life who have left the earth, you know, that they were with me in this process. So I felt kind of a sense of channeling and psychological flow. Mm-hmm. And I just feel very grateful for that. And I think a lot about the prior generations, like how grateful, you know, I think about generational stuff a lot because I've got a 21-year-old, an 18-year-old, I've got aging parents, you know, I think about like, you know, and as I said, I'm a first gen college student. So all the opportunities that I've had that my parents haven't had and that their parents didn't have, and then our kids that have excess, you know? So, I mean, so much has happened in like these short amounts of time. And I think we have to pay generational tribute to those who have come before us. And sometimes there's tensions in generations, right? My parents don't necessarily agree with everything that I talk about or write about. And I don't agree, you know, with certain things and some of the ways of their religion. And so sometimes that can cause a lot of tension. But also I think it helps us to, you know, to grow. And I think we need to acknowledge that generation, those that have come before us. I think that's very, very important. And I'm very grateful. I think for a while there's times in my life where I felt like, especially when I came into the ivory tower, like everybody else had been born with a silver spoon and I was the only plastic spoon.
Right.
And I feel very, very proud of my heritage. And I think about, you know, my grandmothers, like they went through so much and they didn't have the psychology. They didn't have the frameworks. So there's a lot of respect there. But yes, the acknowledgments, it represents a tremendous amount of people in my life that have been supportive.
Yeah, I love the silver spoon versus the plastic spoon. That's another one I hope to hang on to because I definitely was from the plastic spoon side of things, but thrust into a world of silver spoon people.
Yeah, and then, you know, if you feel that imposter syndrome sometimes, you know, or a lot of times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it triggers lots of stories. Maybe I'll put some of that into my commentary on this interview. I think this is a good place maybe for us to wind it up.
Okay.
It feels delightful to be in touch with you again.
And likewise.
Yeah, so Dr. Kristen Lee, I want to thank you for being my guest once again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dave. Take care.
One thing that really comes through both in today's interview and in her latest book is Dr. Kristen Lee's passion. I'm impressed by how fluently she's able to articulate her vision and support it with the latest findings from neuroscience and other quarters as well. As passionate as she is, though, I love her humility in terms of making it clear that she's not saying she has the ultimate claim on truth. She invites the reader to listen to their own intuition. In fact, the constant in her message is the challenge to her audience to have the courage to listen to their own truth and to live it. Again, I'll repeat here the passage I read in the interview, where in the book she writes, "We should be skeptical of any advice that makes big promises or overgeneralizes life's complexity to a simple 1-2-3 solution. There's no quick one-size-fits-all formula to crack life's code." I find that a remarkable statement in a self-help book, and it's one I heartily endorse. This resistance to dogmatism is something that Kristen and I share in common, and probably for pretty much the same reason. We had a lovely off-the-air conversation after the interview. It turns out that we both grew up in situations where we received very strong doses of fundamentalist Christian dogma. As we moved into higher education, we both came to see that view of the universe as limited and inflexible. Much of Kristen's journey has been about her struggle to integrate her commitment to science with her inner emotional life and her own sense of spirituality. And that's a quest I certainly can identify with. If you're looking to challenge yourself and to take a close look at your values and those areas in which you have maybe lost the thread of following your own true self, I think you'll appreciate this book. Working through the exercises in the sessions sections of the book will help you to work your way back to your most authentic self. In fact, I think this is one of those books that would be great to work through with a special other or in a group. It certainly would have the potential to spark some deep sharing, bonding, and support. If you decide to purchase Mintelligence, The New Psychology of Thinking by today's guest, Dr. Kristen Lee, I hope you'll use our Amazon affiliate widget in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com to do so.
Hi, this is Dr. Kristen Lee, author of Mintelligence, A New Psychology of Thinking. It's my pleasure to donate to Shrink Wrap Radio, especially at a time when we're inundated with so much information that is often unhelpful and sometimes plainly false. We need evidence-based psychology, the kind that is integrated and takes into account brain science and focuses on the psyche, heart, and spirit. Dr. Dave is mindful about what he produces, helping us to think and apply new knowledge to do well and be well.
Thank you, Dr. Kristen Lee, for that endorsement. At the risk of sounding too much like a mutual admiration society, I decided to include this here because, yes, I guess we are a mutual admiration society, and there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, Dr. Lee has been a longtime financial supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio. And if you are a repeat listener and are not helping financially, well, you really should. Due to some changes at the Zur Institute, I've not been able to offer any new continuing education courses for some time. Of course, my courses that are there are timeless. So please remember you can get 10% off on all my APA continuing education materials at the Zur Institute, and not just the courses based on my interviews. You can click on that banner ad in our left-hand sidebar, or simply go to zurinstitute.com, search through their extensive catalog, and then use my discount code at checkout, which is Dr. Dave 88. That's D-R-D-A-V-E 88. Do you know that there is a Shrink Wrap Radio app? It's available for Apple, Android, and Windows devices. It will allow you to access the latest 400 or so episodes, plus the ability to call our message phone and more. It's $2.99, but that helps to cover the $30 a month that I'm paying to make it available to you all.
Hi, this is Dr. Kristen Lee, author of Mintelligence, A New Psychology of Thinking, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Kristen Lee, once again, who, of course, was today's guest. Now let's go to a recent email from our listener community. This one is from longtime listener and supporter, naturopath Dr. Ralph Wilson, who, among other things, writes, and I'm going to skip around in his email because some of it is quite personal. He writes, David, I'm feeling very strong and resilient now that I've had nearly 3 years to gradually experiment on myself as I recover from nearly dying when struck by a car while walking within a pedestrian crosswalk outside of a high school. Looking at all the things I've learned from Shrink Wrap Radio, I can see that I've had a widened range of conscious responses to the people in my life, like you. Recently, I found myself thinking of you as a potential expert witness who could testify that the phenomenological experiences that have given me a confidence that I've always been okay on a deep level. I look at my life as exploring the options and then managing the results of actions. I told you those things because I feel that you are a person who cares about me, even if you don't know about or read about the many things that I'm doing to live a good life. You and the Australians and Iranian and Turkish and other listeners are part of a deep imagined world that I carry within myself, people who care and are taking in information to help them in the next moments and next days ahead. Thank you for all you've been doing. You changed my life. Aloha from here, Ralph Wilson. Well, Ralph, thank you for that tribute, and I appreciate the good use you make of me. And like you, I also carry the imaginal world of you and the rest of my listeners out there as a magical seed deep within that nurtures me every day. And I think with that, we'll wrap it up once again for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014, or you can use the Shrink Wrap Radio app to do that. Thanks to today's return guest, Dr. Kristen Lee, for sharing her passion about her new book, Mintelligence, and her new psychology of thinking. Next week, my guest will be Sarah Burden, recommended by listener and social worker Eric Shanks, who writes, "You will absolutely fall in love talking with her. She is speaking so wisely into such an important space in our culture, sex addiction, harassment, objectification, gender roles, trauma, embodiment, self-love, /cultivation, spirituality, creativity, relationships, etc. Dr. Dave, I've been all around, my man, and she is the real deal. Not to mention, she facilitated real fundamental change in me, saved my marriage and sex life, and informed all the work I do with others in a significant way." Well, that's a strong endorsement, so I thought I better take advantage of it. And so I hope that you will join us next time. And until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.